Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking excuses, excuses, excuses as Pep Guardiola and Manchester City crash out of the Carabao Cup to leave all the other teams thinking, hey, we might win a trophy this season. That'd be exciting. We'll also be looking ahead to the best of the weekend's games, and make sure you stay with us for the second half of the show because we're going to be having an in-depth chat about all things modern coaching and also the assistant manager. Are they really the genius behind the managerial success? Joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got Chief Correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, Football Correspondent for The Sunday Times, Johnny Northcroft, and a former footballer who once scored direct from a corner for Chesterfield against Mansfield in 2007 in a 3-1 win, the one and only Gregor Robertson.
You've got a new gag.
There you go.
Get that one quite, Gregor.
Going to have to go through your entire career trajectory to do a new one every single episode.
Could you do some digging then.
Yeah, exactly.
Windy die or vicious in-swinger? What was it?
It was a vicious in-swinger. Vicious in-swinger. Near post, cut the keeper
fantastic.
Out.
Did you mean it?
No, I mean, just a... Put plenty of swaz on it, as they say, you know.
Did you put your hand up in that sort of corner?
Yeah, yeah, celebrate wildly.
No, before you took it, did you this one's going in the near post top corner.
I can't remember, it's a long time ago.
Well, a big moment for Gregor Robertson, and a big moment for Newcastle last night, beating Manchester City, and they were good value for that win. We'll come to them shortly, but we wanted to use their win to talk about excuses. Pep Guardiola, before the match, giving his Manchester City team excuses for their defeat by talking about their travel arrangements and having to get a coach home after the game. Martin, when we were planning the show and talking about the Carabao Cup, this was something that stood out to you as the psychology of the excuse, the managerial excuse. Mm. And you had some interesting views on Pep Guardiola and his tactics for this match.
Well, not so much his tactics for the match. I don't understand, and I'm not about to lecture Pep Guardiola on how to manage a football team, but I don't understand why any manager gives players an excuse to fail. The thing about the coach, I mean, for starters with going to an away match by coach, it does make you wonder how Liverpool did it for all those years and you know, using 14 players in one season. No one got planes in those days and the games were hard and it was a 22 team top division and everything. I can't see the much difference in the time either. I mean, by the time you've got a coach to the airport and sat around on the tarmac and taxied and loaded and everything, and then the same at the other end, I can't see there's going to be much more than an hour in it in terms of just walking out of St James's Park, jumping on a coach, and it's not as if they're on a National Express, you know, squeezed in like sardines.
We've all been there. Great fun, those.
You see these coaches that the teams have got. I mean, they're fantastic. So I don't understand why anyone did it. And what I was saying earlier, is that I know I've mentioned this guy's name a lot, but he was an extraordinarily smart guy. And Terry Venables with England, 1994, took over England, and there was a lot of fuss about chips.
Quite right too. There should always be a fuss about chips.
Players wanting chips at lunch.
Usually it's the condiments, though, isn't it?
Yeah, usually ketchup and everything like that. Usually, but this was about chips, and chips had been banned, and no one was happy. And Terry went to the chef. They didn't have dietitians, I don't think, or nutritionists. They just had the chef, and he went to the chef and said, "Look, is there any way that we could, they can have chips and it's relatively healthy? Is there any way of making chips healthy? And this Jeff explained, as I'm sure we can all work out, Times Readers are a smart bunch, that the problem with chips is the surface area, and that they're very thin, and so you've got a lot of surface area covered in fat. So if you make the chip bigger, it's got a smaller surface area. So, you know, one great big chip is the equivalent of like 20 small chips from McDonald's or whatever, and the fat content of one is much smaller than the fat content of the other. So Terry said, well, so you could do big chips, like very big chips, and they'd still be chips and they'd have less fat content. He said, oh yeah, I could do that. And so that's what they did. And so what it means is we don't win a World Cup on the back of it, but it removes an excuse for dissatisfaction.
So you're saying in that scenario, Venables is going, there you go, I've given you your chips, your one giant chip,
yeah,
enjoy yourself.
Or two, I think it was two,
two
in the end.
It might have been four.
It's a big potato.
Big spud, deep fried.
Yeah.
You've got it.
Yeah.
Be happy. Now get out and train like I want.
You've got no excuse. You've got no excuse for everyone sitting around grumbling, going, oh, you can't even have what you want anymore, and you can't do this and you can't do that. And he was very, very big on that. Very, very big on not necessarily banging on about tiredness, not giving players an excuse to say, oh well, you know, that's why we've lost today, because we didn't get our plane home from Newcastle.
The North East, of course, known for its chips. I've had some many fine chippy teas in my time up there. Maybe Pep should have just gone to the chippy and got everyone on the coach and had a right good knees up on the way home. Johnny, do you agree? Because Pep is known for his excuses, much like a lot of top managers, Jurgen Klopp, Sir Alex Ferguson back in the day. They love an excuse. Do you agree with Martin that a preemptive excuse almost slightly undermined his team before they'd even played here?
I do ask for this to Gregor upstairs, actually, that Pep seemed to get himself in a bit of a tizzy about the whole game before it was even played, starting with the coach. And I mean, he's not a good loser anyway. He's not good when things aren't going the way he wants. But I felt the whole demeanour last night was petulance and annoyance, and that transmitted to the players. The minute Newcastle started getting stuck into them a little bit in the second half, Pep was, his reaction was, that was almost an excuse being ready made on the pitch, that things are really going against us, look at the officials. And that conveys to players. I thought before the game it was strange mood musical, if you want to put it that way, to go in on.
Because he's also talked a lot lately about being tired generally, even before this kind of travel moan. There was a bit of, oh, my players are knackered already.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
It's always around the Carabao Cup as well.
You know,
he wants everyone to break out the small violins, saying that they've not got, you know, the players are exhausted, we've not got enough players for this, when you could easily just delve into your fantastically equipped academy and squad. Yeah,
but surely tiredness doesn't even come into it at this stage in the season, does it? End of September, you should be about as fresh as you can be.
Yeah, I mean, look, the season is like, it never, seems to never end now, in fairness, in modern football. But I completely agree. I think it is a kind of, the psychology before the game was strange. And I said to you before, I remember a manager of mine, Mick Hartford, saying around a heavy kind of festive period of fixtures, when we were tired, when he said before, indicated his kind of pre-match team talk, I don't believe in tiredness. He said, it's all in the mind. And everyone was like, hang on a minute, so I better not look like I'm tired. So, you know, it's a small thing. We're not, you know, it's only a fractional thing. And I think probably the team they put out and the way that they played was obviously far more important. But psychology plays a part in football. There's no question about that.
I don't think physical tiredness is a thing anymore at the top level. I think they're too fit. The squads are too big. Sports science is too good. I think we saw that in COVID, actually, where I wrote, and I think others wrote, articles saying, oh, players will never be able to cope with this workload. We're going to see intensity dropping. And actually, the numbers showed that we didn't see intensity dropping at all, even though they had this crazy sort of crammed in season. But I do think mental tiredness is a thing, to be fair. I think that's where it affects players. But that's where, if you tell them already before a match that they maybe shouldn't be there, then that's not going to freshen their minds to play, is it?
Frank Lampard always said that when, I don't know if I've said this on here before, that when Chelsea were at their absolute peak under Jose Mourinho, that era Chelsea, that if they'd have played at 12:30 on Saturday and they'd have come off at 2:30, having won, as they usually won, And someone had said, you need to go again at 5:30 this evening. You know, we slipped a fixture in and it's the 5:30. He said, you would have gone. Mm. Yeah. Because we were winning. He said, and you just don't feel tired when you're winning. So particularly with Manchester City at the moment, who can't lose a game, it seems, until last night, you do wonder, you know, how tired they actually felt, or whether those guys could just go, we'll keep going.
Klopp does it as well. He banged on about those lunchtime kickoffs on a Saturday. They won recently, didn't they? That broke spell of 12
after an awful first half.
But I think by talking so much about the schedule should be changed, we don't like these lunchtime kickoffs, that must have got into the players.
The one thing I'd be slightly kind of wary about is how much players actually go away and listen to forensically what Klopp says or Pep says in the media. I mean, we obviously do, but you know, you would say that probably the things that he's saying are going to be reflected in what internally. He says to them in the change room as well.
So you didn't listen to much your manager's press conference particularly closely. It was more what he said to you in the changing room when you were playing.
Certainly more. Yeah. I mean, there'd be times where you couldn't avoid it, but
when he slagged you off in the back page.
Well, you definitely avoid those ones. Yeah.
I know the United players in Fergie's day used to be glued to that TV. And that post-match interview, the dressing room would be silent and they'd be watching. What is he going to say? But he always said the same. You know, a few of them that have spoken to me about it, he actually did. He was very consistent. He would say the same thing to them in the dressing room, usually beforehand, that he would say on TV. But they were still waiting for that moment of what's he going to tell the wider world.
Mm. It's an interesting point about the competition in general, because obviously teams like Mansfield, Port Vale, through to the next round, they'll be playing with much smaller squads. I've got my excuses ready for why Martin's mighty West Ham beat my Lincoln City last night. We didn't have a striker. We had to play the same team that we played at the weekend. So that's the only reason you got past us 1-0.
Tom's got a lot more invested in this than I have. in the supposed banter we meant to have about Lincoln versus West Ham. Trust me.
Honestly, he wins one European trophy and he forgets his roots, honestly, down in the Football League.
World Cup.
Anyway, don't start on that World Cup nonsense again. I wasn't even born, I don't believe it. But on the idea of rotation and things, coming back to Newcastle and City, obviously, Eddie Howe did make changes himself. I mean, I wondered whether he would go really strong team, obviously, after the weekend's huge win. Pep makes changes as well. What does it say about Howe, then, that he's kind of got this group of players, Jamal Lascelles, Paul Dummett, Matt Target, Lewis Hall playing on the left? What does it say about him and his management of that group in terms of looking at it and looking at this competition and looking at the season? After 0-0 against AC Milan, 8-0, to then go and beat Manchester City, Johnny.
Yeah, he's managing that group really impressively, and this is like new territory for Eddie Howe, because he worked at Bournemouth obviously for most of his career with that classic small squad, small club where you can be the king of it all and you can have a tight leash on pretty much every player, and he invests in one-on-one sessions. That's part of his coaching. And give that personal touch. Now, this is the first time he's been in European competition that he's had this bigger, fatter squad. And looking at the performance of Livramento, for example, it's just fantastic. But also looking at Anthony Gordon and his impact when he comes on, that shows, you know, they were all in the right place in terms of mindset for that match. And that's Tonali got some useful minutes. And so far, you'd say Eddie Howe's managing this different challenge really, really well. And the cup becomes a useful tool for you when you're in a good moment, because it is that opportunity to, I guess, push the rest of the squad on. So if Livramento plays like he does, that pushes on Kieran Trippier. That pushes on everybody when you can see the replacement doing so well. And he wouldn't have been able to give him those minutes without the cup.
Yeah. Having said that, though, they were poor in the first half, very passive, and the changes, and as we discussed earlier, Johnny, probably a bit of a rocket at half time.
But that's what I mean, that reaction to having made those changes, make more changes, recognise it, bring on star players. That's again a big factor, isn't it, in managing a squad?
Yeah, but also just to kind of reminding them what makes them good, what's made them a success, what's brought them this far, which is getting in their faces, getting in the opposition's faces, pressing high, being relentless. You saw Isaac celebrating, blocking a forward pass in the corner and getting the crowd going. Anthony Gordon, I wasn't entirely sure about You know, we hadn't seen enough of him when he arrived there. But his stature's growing. He is, he's a big player. He's a game changer, and he's got a bit of edge about him as well. He, you know, he smashed Kovacic, I think it was, in the touchline. You know, he lays down markers in games all the time, and he's becoming a really big player for them.
The goal comes through intensity. They flood the box. They overwhelm Rico Lewis with too many bodies in there.
And I think the other thing with Newcastle is that I think they've done a very good job of convincing everybody that they're a lot weaker and more impoverished. And, you know, it's all about, we can't spend a lot of money, and we, you know, we've got to comply with financial, which they are, and I absolutely get that. This is a really good squad. This has got a lot of strength in depth. When you look at some of the teams this season, and I'm talking about the elite teams, you know, the ones that wanted to form a Super League and all of that, those teams, and you look at their bench and you look at Newcastle's bench, Newcastle's bench is better. It really is. I mean, when you think of Livermento and Hall and the money that was paid for those players, and they can't get in the team.
30 million each, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So £60 million on fullbacks there. And it's a strong, you know, they're alternating Isaac and Callum Wilson, who would be centre forward at a lot of clubs. A lot of clubs would get into a lot of teams. You know, and at the same time, Eddie, because he's Eddie, and I think he's got a fairly, you know, everyone has bought into it up there as well, and so they're, you know, they're writing it and his master's voice, and he says, we haven't got the same sort of squad, we haven't spent the money. Everyone goes, no, this is, and you're looking at it thinking, no, this club's going places. It's a surprise they got there as quickly as they did into that top four. But when you look at that squad, it's not a surprise that that's a top four squad.
No.
It really isn't, because they've got...
Financial backing helps a little bit.
Financial backing always helps.
We have to put that asterisk next to it. Yeah. Someone has to.
A good coach always helps, and good players help. Yeah. And they've got good players.
Yeah, definitely. No doubt. Johnny, you mentioned there about the cup competitions being a good thing for a team in form.
Yeah.
It can also be a good thing for a team out of form. Chelsea, they finally scored. They finally won a game.
Yeah.
Gregor, you must be delighted having been at Stamford Bridge and casting aspersions over their chances in front of goal.
Yeah, delighted for Jackson, because whatever people have said about him, he works so hard, really, really hard, always. And, you know, I think there's a reason why you could see actually in the celebrations that everyone was so delighted for him. And I think Pochettino is often singing his praises about his work rate and about, you know, how he's young, he's got a lot to learn, and how he thinks he could be a really huge striker in Europe. So it's a big moment for him, although now he's suspended for the next game on Saturday. So
well, we covered that indiscretion on Monday's show, didn't we? So, I mean, Chelsea, thinking about, it's just popped into my head because, again, we were on the editing desk the other day and talking about press conferences, and Pochettino's came in and Tom Roddy was there and said, you know, believe what he said. He's talked about doing crossbar challenge with Mikhailo Mudryk and all the players. And we were like, what is he on about? Why is he trying to hit the crossbar with players when he should be trying to put the ball in the back of the net? And, you know, thinking like editors, how are we going to scheme this into some kind of story? But actually, was that a bit of clever, you know, Fergie-esque distraction tactics, do we think, Johnny, maybe, to get people talking after another defeat at the weekend, going into a cup game, get us journalists and editors talking about something a bit of nonsense, crossbar challenge, and, oh, he should be better than me. Is that a bit of clever management, maybe?
Probably. He doesn't, I mean, he's quirky in his press conferences, Poch, anyway. He'll talk about lemons, you know. He's quite good at sort of throwing you that way. But I thought that was nice, actually. I thought it humanised things quite well, and it actually gave him the opportunity to sort of pump up Mudryk a little bit anyway, because he was able to then use that to get the message out, this guy doesn't know how good he is, he needs to believe in how good he is.
Would he want that message out, though? I read that thinking, if I'm Mudryk, really? Thinking
I can't hit the crossbar against my manager.
Do I need my manager telling the world that I'm kind of a bit low in confidence and I'm a kind of player who might need the arm around the shoulder or the manager to let me win at crossbar challenge or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I'd thought of it that way. I guess...
He's also teed it up for the next time he has a shot clean through on goal and he hits the crossbar. I tell you what, me and James will be doing straight away with the headline.
What it made me think, I think I'm about the same age as Poch, and one of the things that goes as an athlete, you'll find this, Tom, when you sort of getting to a more middle stage of life.
Thanks for ever considering me an athlete, by the way, given that I'm sat next to a former footballer. But anyway, carry on.
Well, Gregor might be finding this out, but you start to lose your ability to ping a ball. So if Poch can still hit a
never
crossbar,
had that.
Wow, that's pretty good going. I don't think I can get it off the ground anymore.
Yeah, Martin, on those comments then, and on Pochettino, and on this result for Chelsea.
I was actually thinking of the crossbar challenge. Wasn't that the fallout, so to speak, with Glenn Hoddle and David Beckham? Wasn't that the skill?
Something like that, wasn't it?
You're obviously not good enough to do that skill, because it was Glenn's party piece.
Was it?
That he could hit the crossbar. He could hit the crossbar, you know, at will almost. And
what, he challenged Beckham to do it in training?
So
and
it was 1998. Yeah, 1998. It was a training session, and it was him and Beckham, and Beckham couldn't do it. Beckham couldn't get it. He's not that he couldn't do it. I mean, why would you want to hit the crossbar? I've never quite understood it. But anyway, he couldn't do it. And that was, Glenn Hoddle's very dismissive. You're obviously not good enough to do that skill. Yeah. Which was the beginning of this sort of wedge beginning to form between him and the players, because people like David Beckham.
Interesting.
And there's a lot of Manchester United players in the team, and they thought that Glenn Hoddle had embarrassed him.
Interesting.
In front of everybody. And that was the beginning of it beginning to start to unravel. And then he leaves him out, and he leaves Michael Owen out, and then he has to bring him back and everything like that.
Well, hopefully that doesn't happen with Mikhailo Mudryk. Gregor, any good at hitting the crossbar? Good at scoring from corners? Any good at hitting the crossbar?
It was all right. I had Soccer AM in a couple of teams at a couple of clubs to do that, and I never had to. I was close, but I never had to.
I can envisage a game podcast live where we get some listeners on against Gregor and Tony Cascarino to see if they can hit the crossbar. Moving on to other clubs who were grateful for a win, Manchester United beating Crystal Palace. The trademark goal for Anthony Martial at this time of the year, so he'll start the pieces. Is this going to be his run, and then he'll get injured and miss the next couple of games? But a big win for Erik ten Hag, Johnny.
Big win. Garnacho scoring was good for him. I think the story was Amrabat getting his minutes on the pitch and looking pretty good at left back. And we've talked about him last week. I think he does have a lot of personality, and it's what that team needs at the moment. I did see them at Burnley at the weekend, and it was better. It was a step forward for them, but they still played like the smaller team against, you know, a team just promoted who dominated possession and territory for a lot of the game. So I came away from that thinking there's this, you know, United maybe turned the corner, but there's a long way to go. So
careful on the turning the corner. Turning the corner again.
Well, their history is that they're just capable of turning it back, aren't they? But that was another step forward, I think. Mm. And I think they need more than just Casemiro in terms of personality. Yeah. So I think Amrabat's got real potential. But left back, it makes sense at the moment, playing inverted and coming in and using his passing range from in the middle. That might be something in Luke Shaw's absence that we could see more of.
It's interesting, though, that he ends up there having everyone and Manchester United fans crying out for a second midfielder alongside Casemiro, and then Ten Hag sticks him in at left back. It does show that absence of Luke Shaw is a massive, massive miss for them, doesn't it?
Yeah, because Luke Shaw was one of the most, if not the most, improved player last season. I think, from a high base, but he was fantastic for a lot of the season and in a creative role, not just the defensive, but really what he did getting forward, coming inside, and then allowing Rashford the sort of space, making the space for Rashford to attack was really important. So, and you're not going to get that on the right from Wan-Bissaka. So it could be a reasonable solution for them in Shaw's absence.
Everton, Martin, is the other team. 2-2 mm-hmm. for Dominic Calvert-Lewin. We're talking about making changes and resting players. Pretty strong team from Sean Dyche, as you would perhaps expect going to Aston Villa. But a good win for them in terms of the momentum for their season now.
I thought that was the narrative of this round in many ways, that there were teams. I always think of the Carabao Cup, the early rounds of the Carabao Cup get managers sacked, because if you've had a bad start to the season and then suddenly you get turned over at Plymouth on a Tuesday night, that's when the ball goes, right, we can't tolerate this anymore, and you get the bullet. Whereas in this round of the Carabao Cup, there were three teams, in fact, that managed to get a result that was really needed, Manchester United obviously being the first, and Chelsea as well, but Everton being the third. So there's suddenly a small degree of momentum there, which is what Dyche needs and what he hasn't been able to achieve so far. That's you know, that's what he's been looking for. The, you know, the old joke about not being able to win enough games to have a slump. That was Everton, and now suddenly they've got back to back wins. They're into the last 16, which, you know, is always. I think cup runs are good. I've never understood why fans sometimes have now been brainwashed into thinking, oh, we don't want to win a cup. We want to come, you know, 16th or whatever. That's the most important thing. Because I think they build confidence. Mm. I think a good cup run builds confidence as much as anything else. I was talking to Mark Hughes the other week, who's at Bradford, and he was certainly excited by the fact they've got through the first three rounds, that they got knocked out this week. Mm. But it's Bradford, they're in the fourth division. So, but he was excited by this little bit of momentum, and they you know, they drawn a game in the last minute, and they've got a couple of late goals in their league matches this season, and he seemed to be suggesting that, you know, it was that sort of energy that they'd got from winning some of the early cup rounds.
It's interesting, that point about the impact it can have on managers, because I was at Leicester Blackburn last year. I think it was the quarterfinals, might have been the round before the quarters, where Leicester got knocked out at home in the cup. Took my daughters, and that was the first time I think that Brendan Rodgers got kind of boos and the crowd starting to turn against him. And it was a classic where he'd rotated the side, he was trying to give people minutes, maybe underestimated how good Blackburn were going to be, went out at home. But what became clear was the difference between how much the fans had invested in that game. They'd turned up Wednesday night, I think, in December, and to be sort of disappointed in that way, the fury started to come out in Rodgers. And I think that's the balancing act for managers who are rotating. West Ham had 1,800 fans at Lincoln last night. That
big game. That's why.
Show some respect. Don't often get a chance to go to Central Bank.
Exactly.
But you think to yourself, David Moyes, I think, rotated 10, and that's a gamble when you've got 1,800 fans who've made that journey and aren't turning up to see a kind of friendly match. And he got away with it. You know, they'd have gone home happy, but. Mm. It's difficult because obviously the manager's got to look at the whole season. We know why they rotate, but it's still a competition.
Isn't Luton,
it? Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Luton Town had lost to Exeter, and you know, you could say they definitely need a win. Mm. And yeah. I think for the first time, like, no doubts about Rob Edwards or anything, but he kind of had to hold his hands up and say, "Look, this is my fault." And you know, I think probably realise that he got that wrong, and it was an opportunity to kind of have a bit of happiness and get a win, which they badly need.
A great win for Exeter.
I don't think Sam Allardyce at West Ham, and I might be remembering this, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but I don't think his relationship with West Ham's fans ever recovered from going to Nottingham Forest.
Yep, 5-0.
Putting out basically reserve. I think there were seven guys that never played another game for West Ham in that team. They were very, very clear young players. They weren't ready for the first team. And you know, Johnny set the score 5-0. And I don't think he ever his relationship with the fans ever really recovered from that, because West Ham aren't going to win the league. So the FA Cup is going to be as good as it gets. Cup competitions for a lot of teams these days are going to be quite probably as good as it gets. Mm. And they matter.
Yeah.
They really do matter. Newcastle Manchester City last night, and you know, I'm not saying this is why they win or whatever. Winning the League Cup would matter so much more to Newcastle than it does to Manchester City right now.
Yeah.
You know, no matter that they've got PSG next week, and you know, I get that. And I don't think it should have been on the television. I think there were better, you know, cup giant killing potential games that they should have put on ahead of this match, which is the least significant meeting of Newcastle and Manchester City that will probably play this season. Having said that, what is undeniable is that winning a trophy, any trophy, would be huge for Newcastle.
Gregor, just to finish with you on the rotation thing and what the guys were talking about, of when you're playing, doesn't matter, you just want to keep playing. That's true, isn't it? You know, all this idea of being... We started at the top talking about excuses and tiredness, but when it comes to cup runs and the league, you just want to keep playing, don't you?
Yeah, although there's even psychology in that too, because if there are some people changed and you're left in... It's almost like there's a hierarchy. Mm. You think, why is he being rested and I'm not? Footballers are a weird bunch, honestly. But, you know, if you kept the whole team and you're happy to be, absolutely, you're happy to keep playing and winning. No question about that.
Still something simmering away underneath him there. He definitely got picked in the cup game when everyone else got rested, didn't he? We'll come to that story for the next week's intro, perhaps. So, yeah, Mansfield and Port Vale facing each other in the next round, hoping, knowing that, please God, if we win, we'll get a big tie in the quarterfinals. So good luck to them and congratulations to Exeter as well. Stick with us. Up next, we'll be talking all things coaches. If you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed. And if you're enjoying the Rugby World Cup at the minute, as well as a bit of football, make sure you check out The Ruck, our sister podcast. They've been doing some brilliant things, including a series with former captains on how to win the World Cup. Just search for The Ruck wherever you get your podcasts.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and I've got Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor Robertson with me. Up next, we're talking all things coaching, modern coaches, assistant managers, and the reason being, Johnny, you've done two big hitting pieces for the Sunday Times in recent weeks. The first was a few weeks ago where you spoke to a young coach who can speak German, Portuguese. He gets up to run at 5:30 in the morning. He's got three kids. He's worked with Thomas Tuchel and Harry Kane and Cristiano Ronaldo, and he's the best British coach you've never heard of. And his name is Anthony Barry. Tell us a bit more about him.
What a great sell. he's learning Portuguese and German.
I know, I knew you were going to clarify.
He's trying.
Listen, if he's learning, he's speaking in my book. That's all I can say.
Is that right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We'll give him that. Yeah. Come on, we'll give him that.
That wouldn't have been my German teacher's definition of me between ages 11 and 16.
I'm trying.
I'm learning. So he's speaking it.
Ask me, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
But it's typical, actually, of Anthony. Maybe it's a good starting point. I mean, he's incredibly energetic. He's an absolute energy bomb of a person. And I'd spoken to him on the phone and actually on Zoom before, but I hadn't met him in the flesh, and that was the first thing that kind of strikes you. It's someone's personal energy and their demeanour, and I always then think, how would that be as somebody working for them and playing for them? And he would be one of those that would just absolutely fill you with enthusiasm. But his energy is such, as you see, you described his routine, you know, he said he doesn't sleep very much and never has. But with languages, he set himself the goal of delivering a session in Portuguese to that Portugal team.
Yeah. So I was going to say, that was mine was an ethereal intro. Yeah, but, you know, the reason being is that he's currently working for Bayern Munich and Portugal.
So, I mean, to give you his potted history, he was a reasonable player at youth level, but actually played in the same youth team as Wayne Rooney for Everton. But then classically didn't deliver on the promise and started coaching quite early under Paul Cook, who and John Coleman, two of who, if you look at the coaches who've come through, who've worked with them, they're kind of unsung heroes, I think, of the English coaching kind of firmament. So he started with Cook at Wigan, and while working at Wigan, had to push to get himself onto the pro license course and the LMA manager's diploma because he was of such a low level, but sort of forced his way in the door, and then produced this incredible thesis for the pro license where he watched 17,000 throw-ins and wrote a dissertation on the undervalued
17,000
throw-ins. Yeah, well, he said he had a gut instinct that you know, the old-fashioned way of chuck it down the line and sort of see
what Gregor used to do.
Yeah, not very far either.
I was coached the same way, and it's maybe. Yeah. Anyway, so he had just had an instinct that was probably not the best way to do things, you know, but there might be a cleverer way to do it with throw-ins. And it was around about the time Liverpool brought in Thomas Gronemark, and we were all in the media sort of having a bit of a titter about throw-in coaches, whatever next. And Anthony kind of thought that maybe there's a good point because there are more restarts via throw-ins than any other set piece, for example. Anyway, I've digressed into throw-ins. He found there was a big correlation between teams that can keep possession from a throw-in and league success and teams that just sort of chuck it down the line, and that was one of his findings. Became published. He was a star pupil of the pro license, and it was quite a good cohort at Michael Carrick, Kola Touré, Frank Lampard, and off the back of that, Frank brought him into Chelsea as initially set pieces were his kind of thing, and Chelsea,
he had an impact too, didn't he?
Massive impact. Chelsea set pieces just completely turned around. He then started working with Ireland with Stephen Kenny, who he didn't know at all, but Kenny brought him in. He did set pieces with Ireland and he did defensive structure, and again Ireland's results sort of turned around. And then since then he's had a kind of a dual career where he's been a national team assistant and he's been a club assistant. He went from Ireland to Belgium with Roberto Martinez, and then with Martinez to Portugal.
It's quite striking that the people who meet him and work with him then take him on. Because that's also what happened with Tuchel, right? From Chelsea to Bayern.
He was the one remnant of Frank's staff that Tuchel kept on. Not that Tuchel looked at the other ones and didn't want them, but they left with Frank and Anthony decided to see if Tuchel wanted them, and they just hit it off. They really, really hit it off. I think Tuchel's a very energetic and kind of, you know, bloke that's just full of thoughts and ideas.
And Bayern paid a 7-figure sum for him, right? In terms of like not a transfer, but yeah, in terms of compensation.
No, they paid about £1 million for him, and that might be unprecedented in terms of. Or Chelsea probably subsequently given Brighton £20 million for someone we don't even know. But Bayern paid a lot of money to get him, but Tuchel's brought him not just as, you know, what part of the staff, but as his proper number two, and he fulfills that role for Portugal now. But I think we're going to get on to talk about the role of the number two. What's fascinating is how much power in the modern game, or how much responsibility in the modern game a lot of number twos are given, I think, because management and coaching has become such an enormous job.
Yeah.
And it's different, but it depends on which manager you're working with. So at Bayern, Anthony's job with Tuchel's to really be his kind of mirror, really. I think they work very closely together on the attacking side of the game, but also on things like recruitment and, you know, devising game strategy. Whereas with Portugal, it's more to do with he's got more of a, you know, Martinez just tells him to organise training, you devise the training plans, you set it all up, kind of thing. And Martinez takes more of that kind of managerial role, as it were. And he does a lot of one-to-one work with the players. So him and Ronaldo seem to have hit it off quite well. And him and Harry Kane, obviously, and so on.
But in your piece, he told a great story about Ronaldo, didn't he? In terms of the preparations and the fact that they were on a journey back from a game
they were flying to Iceland, and it was, he said, it was just a normal plane. You know, Portuguese FA hadn't chartered anything fancy. It was just a normal plane. And it was a nighttime flight as well, so Anthony got up to go and use the toilet. And he said he walked down the aisle of the plane, and all the players are on their iPads watching films or whatever. And he got to the back of the plane, and Ronaldo had made a space for himself and was trying to fit in a little session in the sort of half an hour he had before landing. Was working on his legs and stuff like that. And that's the first time they spoke properly. And he said he sat down with them, and then he said, I said, you know, when you've come from Wigan and you've come from this background, and then you have to work with a real elite, how do you actually connect with them? And he said, look, it's really simple. With the best players, just want to win. The really elite guys, they just want to win, and they just want to get better. And if they think you can give them even 0.5%, that'll make them, give them a chance of getting better and win, they'll buy into you. But equally, if you're a bit of a bluffer, they'll leave you straight away. Mm. So you've got to show them that you know your stuff. He said you've got to know your stuff so well. Because another thing he said was top players know the game better than us coaches. He said that's just a fact. So you have to almost be so on top of everything, the methodology, what your beliefs are, that you can demonstrate to them and communicate very quickly and clearly, because also they don't want to hang around. You've got to communicate really quickly and clearly. I know what I'm talking about, and I can help you here and buy into them. And I think that Kevin De Bruyne's another one that he found high demands but brilliant to work with at Belgium, for exactly the same reason. De Bruyne's so driven, just wants to be better all the time, and quite quick to get disillusioned if he doesn't think he's being helped.
Absolutely fascinating, Johnny. Martin, I want to come to you because there's a line in Johnny's piece which says, Barry's ambition is to be a head coach at the top of the game, but there's no hurry, which hints at a slight kind of foreboding about these coaches that are so revered, so admired by the likes of Cristiano Ronaldo and the top players. And then when they maybe move into the number one spot, they can't quite pull it off as a manager, as a head coach. What do you think of that within football, and, you know, names that spring to mind that have been great coaches and that maybe haven't made it at the very top?
I think the head coach is pretty much everything. Always have done. And I've seen so many in the past. Colin Harvey with Harold Kendall. Harold Collins, the brains behind the operation, and then Harold Kendall leaves and Colin Harvey takes over the team, and it wasn't Harold Kendall's Everton. Same with Ray Harford and Kenny Dalglish. I love Ray. Absolutely, you know, what a fellow Ray was. And but he wasn't Kenny Dalglish. He wasn't Kenny Dalglish. He didn't have that same that same instinct, and he wasn't fundamentally Kenny Dalglish, who could, you know, Alan Shearer will tell you that one of the only guys that ever taught him anything about scoring goals was Kenny Dalglish. About slightly delaying your shot, because then the defender will put his leg out and you can hit it through, and then the goalkeeper doesn't see it until late if you've really got great technique. And that came from Kenny Dalglish. And, you know, and this is not to decry Johnny's piece, and it's not to decry the worth of looking at 17,000 throw-ins. You know, there will obviously be some value in that. The more you study something, the more you should learn, the better you'll get at it. That was Sir Clive Woodward's point about repetition in penalties and things like that. However, the day that the results aren't bad and the board of directors meet and say we're going to sack the throwing coach is the day that I will take those guys more seriously than I take the fella who is actually going to get the bullet. There's a story about Martin O'Neill when he was manager of Leicester, when he started when he started at Leicester, and they couldn't win. They just couldn't win. Yeah. I don't know if you can remember this run of matches. It was like dreadful. I think they had to barricade themselves into the dressing room at one stage because the fans had invaded the pitch and got down the tunnel, and they literally had to hide in their own dressing room and push things up against the door because they thought their own fans were going to murder them. And Martin's sitting in his office. He's got this game coming up on the Wednesday, and if he doesn't win it, he can't see, you know, there's no way forward, and he thinks he's going to get the bullet. And if he gets the bullet there, what he's only managed Wickham so far, he's thinking this could be the end of his managerial career, any trust that's facing him. And the fella comes in who's like the youth team coach or academy director or whatever, and he's sitting in there, and Martin's like head in his hands and stuff, and the fella says to him, "Oh, it's not all bad though, Martin." He said, "We've got some smashing 15-year-olds coming through." He said, and Martin looked at him and he said, "FNL used to me is that." Yeah. It's absolutely true. Now, that was this guy's job, and it's a really important job, and it's really important that Leicester do have good 15-year-olds coming through. But if you have got to win on Wednesday night, otherwise you are going to get the bullet, that really is not your concern, and not that significant. You will not be taking any great solace from that.
The point on Kenny Dalglish is the one I want to come back to, because it links slightly to something you said that Anthony had said about his kind of coming up, and that, you know, speaking to Cristiano Ronaldo and the like, I've got to justify myself here because he's thinking, who the hell am I? Do you think that is easier to do as a coach who can go, I can tweak, I've got my 17,000 throw-in thesis, and I can tweak your game slightly to give you an extra 1%, as opposed to being in the top job, where if you're not Kenny Dalglish and the players are going, bloody hell, it's Kenny Dalglish. Mm. Do you think that's a factor for these coaches?
100%, and I am on board with what Martin says, that it is always about number ones ultimately, that a coach has got a different job, and I think that's what a good one recognises. So Anthony recognises his job's different to Thomas Tuchel. Mm. He has to perform that. He has to have, and this isn't a new thing. You know, if you speak to the United players, going back to them again, to the Fergie era, Brian Kidd had that job with them. His job was to be the guy that he took training. Fergie didn't really take training, and Brian Kidd had that job to do the teaching and the coaching and to be close to them and to be their mate and to impart those little bits of knowledge sometimes, or those technical things that head coach might want to take a bit of a step back. Ange Postecoglou, I think we might have been about to talk about him, and I wrote about him last week, and I know his number two, Chris Davis, quite well. Brilliant young coach as well, who worked with Brendan Rodgers at Celtic and Swansea and Liverpool and Leicester. Ange has got the old Brian Clough style, where he almost says nothing through the week, and he stands and he watches, but he sees absolutely everything. And when he does deliver, it's incredibly impactful. That means the number two's job is to be very hands-on with the coaching. But it's that's almost to enable Ange to keep his authority. Mm. I think different head coaches want to do it in different managers want to do it in different ways, and the number two's got to be appropriate to that style of managing. The line about Anthony and his sort of no hurry. I mean, I think he said to me he's in love with Thomas Tuchel. Mm-hmm. You know, he is at the best in his mind finishing school that he could ever have. He wants to absorb everything that Tuchel's got, but at some point he'll want to be.
And he's only 37?
37, yeah. 38.
So there really is no hurry in that respect.
There is no hurry, but I suppose some of them do try, as Martin said, the world's littered with, I mean, Fergie alone must have had 25 number twos who never amounted to number ones.
Brian Kidd, of course, being the example of someone who went to be a manager.
And also, you notice that the club goes up the pictures the minute that Fergie leaves, not the minute that a number two, one of these 20-odd number twos, Archie Knox, Brian Kidd, Steve McLaren or whatever. Mm.
Rennie Mullenstein.
They Carlos keep winning Kieros, the league and they keep being successful, and then Fergie leaves and suddenly it's kaput. Mm. So
the difference between leadership and coaching—that's the ultimate.
Exactly.
I just want to say that I think there are guys who go on, do the finishings and then absorb it. You know, Arteta is a glaring example at the moment, of course, of somebody that probably stayed for just long enough with Guardiola, but then
has been very much his own man. But I think Capello did it with Sacchi, didn't he, in Milan back in the day. Walter Smith.
Mourinho?
Did it for a long time. Mourinho, of course, was Van Gaal's number two. So it's possible to make that jump, but I think the key is not to have the humility and not to think it's you and not the head coach, but also to time it.
We'll come back to Chris Davis. Paul Clement, another great example.
Paul Clement, Carlo Ancelotti, and various people, and Carlo taking him all around Europe. Yeah. We're thinking, God, this guy's going to be amazing. When he eventually emerges from Carlo Ancelotti's shadow, Paul Clement is going to rock the coaching world. And
I think he's unlucky. But that's another conversation.
He could well be. Gregor, there's a lot of unlucky fellas.
Absolutely, they really are.
And he could be one of them.
We'll come back to Chris Davis, Johnny, because I want to talk about that piece separately in its own right. But Gregor, a couple of points on this. You did one of your coaching badges with Anthony Barry, right?
Did my UEFA B licence with him. Yeah, we were both kind of, you know, as you say, he's about 38, I'm 39, we were roughly the same age. I played against him in League One a few times. He had a proper, you know, Johnny skirted over his, he had a career. He played for, you know, there were lower league teams, Accrington, Stanley, Yeovil, Chester, I think, Fleetwood. Sometimes it was the high paying teams in the National League and stuff. Yeah. So he had a career, and I think, as Johnny said, when he was maybe 27, 28, he started coaching. But on the UEFA B, there were two people who stood out to me, like, immediately, and it was him and Laura Bassett.
How many people are in that pool then when you're doing it? Is it a small, you know, is it 5-6
it like
huge?
20-30 maybe.
Right.
Matt Gill was another, who's now assistant to Russell Martin at Southampton. But they were the two. Because the thing I'd be fascinated to see his career, because he's come from lower league football, and then he suddenly, you know, he's won the Champions League with Chelsea, and he's going to, you know, he's clearly so highly thought of by Frank Lampard, by Thomas Tuchel, by these huge names. From where he's come from, which was something I kind of can associate with a bit, it's fascinating to see that. But the thing he spoke about, the thing you've got to be is competent, and so I saw that he was competent. But it's also, there's a part of it is personality as well. And he spoke about how he felt a little bit, how am I going to be able to stand up and speak in front of people? And I can relate to that as well. This is such an alien thing for a footballer to do. Like
presumably that's part of the course, right? They give you those. Were they challenges?
Not
if
so
you
much.
Like.
No? Not so much. It's about the fundamentals of, like, you know, you talk about the four corners, four corners, technical, tactical. I can't even remember them. Psychological.
that's why you're in here.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why our careers diverge. But no, it's more about the kind of the nuts and bolts of being able to put on a session. Those other things are things that you either have naturally, which he had a bit of, and Johnny's spoken about his
energy.
He hired
a presentation
energy,
coach.
But he actually, he went to a speaker, joined a speakers club. So the thing I always thought was about, you know, I've written a piece about this, about people where you come from a low base, or you're not a footballer at all, and you've always got a hurdle to overcome. But if you're bright, you generally, you'll be hardworking, and you'll have some energy about you. But that's the most important thing. Like, there's so many footballers who, you know so much about football, but they don't know how to articulate what they know. And so if someone who puts in years of work that also footballers haven't done, because they've been playing football, they put in years of work as a coach, and he'd put in work, Laura Bassett had put in work, because she played in women's football, where mostly, you know, she played for Birmingham, and your job was double, you know, was twin pronged. It was like you worked in the community, you went out and coached, and then you played for the part-time for a women's team. So the reason the two people who stood out were so good was because they'd done it. They'd gone away and off their own volition, or, you know, they'd been coaches, whereas everyone else was coming towards the end of their career and, like, you know, all right, I need to tick a box. I need to get my badges. Yeah. I need to be a foot, you know.
So
if I want to be a coach, I need to do this.
Was that what you
had
doing?
Been a coach.
Was that what you were doing, ticking the boxes? Jokes aside, because obviously you now went into the media and into journalism. Is it like a reflex? I'm retiring, I must do my badges.
It was like, I think I should do this because I might, you know, I did the journalism course because I thought I should do this in case I like it. I didn't know, you don't know what to do when you finish a lot of the time. It's hard.
Yeah.
So I did the coaching badges, and I found I did quite like it, but I just, there were some, that's why I was so interested in reading that. There were some things about, sort of doubts about yourself that Anthony Barry had, that I could see, I shared.
So what were the biggest doubts you had that you, like, weren't able to overcome?
It's not that I wasn't able to overcome them. It's just that I didn't do all the things he did, because I took this route.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I would have. Maybe I don't know. But and maybe I wouldn't have been good enough. But the fact is, you have to engage. Often, if you want to be good, you have to engage players who probably were better than you, and you have to be sort of different as well. I think if you want to be successful, you have to be able to plan your own sessions, and you know, it's not easy coaching. It's like it used to be a kind of you put on a session and then you know, a small sided game, and then you play a game on the Saturday, and it's not anymore. You need to be able to engage players because they want to buy into something.
Coaches are teachers, and there's one reason there's only one Pep Guardiola. It's not just the IP that he's got. It's how he communicates with people, how he teaches players, how he connects with them, and that's maybe that indefinable thing that you have to try to find to see if you've got it or not, or if you want to have it, or maybe you can develop it. I don't know.
To Martin's point about then, you know, coaches, head coaches, and esteem. Did you firstly have a similar thing with where if the manager was of a certain esteem, a certain reputation, that added some kudos, if you like, to what he was saying, or compared to a coach who you were like, I've never heard of this bloke.
Yeah, but it doesn't last.
I always
refer to Rainer Bonhoff in the Scotland under 21s team, and like, he won the World Cup when he was 22. He was a colossus of a midfield player for Germany. I think he won the European Cup with Valencia. And
I think so, yeah.
You know, so he stands up, he speaks, you listen. But almost nothing of what he said stayed in your mind because he wasn't a coach. He wasn't, you know, he just wasn't very good, to be brutally honest. And like, he's not been a coach. He didn't stay in that line of work long. I think he went into kind of a directorial role at one of his clubs in Germany. So, you know, that's one example. And then I often the chemistry is the other thing. The other one I would refer to is Chris Wilder and Alan Nil, who, you know, took Sheffield United from League One to the Premier League. You know, they wowed the Premier League with these overlapping centre halves and stuff. That was Alan Nil. Mm. Everyone say, "Oh, Chris Wilder." No, that was Alan Nil, absolutely. And their dynamic was shifted earlier in their career. Alan Nil had been the manager,
really,
and Chris Wilder was his assistant at Bury. But their personalities, again, it comes back to personality and leadership. Their personalities absolutely suit the way it is now. Not only because Wilder's a really good coach, Alan Nil's a really good coach, but because Wilder is kind of a leader and he's intense and he's really like demanding and sometimes a little bit scary. Alan Nil didn't really have that. But he's really smart, and he did all the stuff about analysing set pieces and watching obscure football to see if you could find a little edge.
Spartak Moscow did that against Blackburn, that thing with the centre halves, and that was against Ray Harford's Blackburn because Kenny had won the league, got them into the Champions League, and got them into the Champions League, and then left, and Ray got the job that he'd always wanted. And suddenly it's a little bit different. They were playing Spartak Moscow in their first game in the Champions League on, I want to say, the Tuesday night. And I had dinner with Ray on the Monday night. And he'd given this weird press conference about getting up and at them and getting in their face and all the stuff that you knew Ray didn't actually believe. Ray liked good football and keeping it on the ground and knocking it about. It wasn't Route One man at all, and this, he was talking about getting in their faces and they won't have faced an English team and stuff, and we're sitting there having dinner, and I said to him, "Do you really believe that?" I said, do you really think that?" I said, that's the way you've got to go against Spartak Moscow." I said, "No." He said, "We've got no chance." He said, they're different class than us." He said they've got two centre halves, and he described how these guys played, and it was Nikiforov and Viktor Anokhko, and he described how they played, and this, like, it was basically like Petit and Vieira used to play in midfield but operating at centre half, and one went and the other stayed, you didn't know who was going to take the ball out of the back next. He said I'm fighting out of my... I've watched them in a different class to us. And they were, basically, and they should have won the Champions League that season, but it was that classic Russian thing. They came out of the group with six wins out of six, and then basically sold the entire team in the January transfer window.
Got knocked out,
I think, by Nantes or someone like that. You know, it was like ridiculous.
See, it wouldn't surprise me if Alan Neil knew about that.
Yeah, and probably. Like, almost
and certainly. I just remember speaking to him about it after, and he said that it was in League One when they played against Walsall once. And because they were the big club, and, you know, teams would sit in a really low block. It's like they were just desperate to find another overload, and that's when it started. But no one recognised it until they got to the Premier League.
Johnny, coming back to Chris Davies, you mentioned him before. I just want to quickly mention him because that was the second piece. Number two to Ange Postecoglou, of course. Tell us a bit more about him, because you were mentioning how he kind of leads the training sessions and Ange kind of sits back. Tell us a bit more about that dynamic.
Yeah, again, it's a different dynamic to the one Chris had at with Brendan, where it was maybe more like the one I described between Barry and Tuchel, where they were very close. Like, Brendan was Chris's manager, I think, at Reading under-18s. Chris was his under-18 captain, so they had this relationship that went all the way back. He got a knee injury, went into Swansea as an analyst and worked for Brendan that entire time. So they were very, you know, like sort of two sides of the same coin, whereas Ange famously goes from job to job without taking an entourage of staff with him, which I find really fascinating because it goes against what we see nearly every coach do. And I think it's partly because you can be all kind of get into his backstory and, you know, immigrant family who learnt very much to thrive in an alien environment and have that spirit, and that's what his dad was like, that's what he's like. He doesn't want to have safety nets, he wants to go and start afresh. So there's part of that, but I think it's partly clever trying to get different and new knowledge. But as I said before, what he wants his number two to do is, you go and do all the coaching, but I will deliver the messaging, and I will stand and watch. And Chris said to me when I talked to him about Ange that he might go 3 days without saying something, and then you'll discuss a player and you'll say, you know, what about him for the weekend? And you'll say, yeah, well, you know, he's done okay. And Andrew will go, yeah, but on Thursday there was that throw-in, and he, you know, didn't turn his body the right way. And he has seen every single detail.
So he stood there being quiet, but has actually spotted absolutely everything.
Everything, yeah. And also as a coach, you feel, wow, he's really on top of everything. I do as well. But it enables Ange to keep that order. And I think Martin mentioned Martin O'Neill, that he had the same kind of...
similar sort of thing.
He let Steve Walford do a lot of the coaching, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
And then Martin had that aura that when he spoke and when he delivered something, it was special.
And you can also be the fun guy as well. That's the other thing, that there's that dynamic as well, that you get somebody else to do all of that horrible stuff that players hate doing. And Clough would do that. He'd have Alan Hill, I think, have them running up and down. You know, we're talking about rather unsophisticated times by comparison to now, but literally running up and down the terraces to do conditioning work. And then it would be Clough that came out and went, what are we doing this for? Let's get the ball out and everything. And it was all worked out. He wasn't actually undermining it. Alan Hill knew exactly what was going to happen, but it made Clough seem like the fun guy. Venables did it with Van Gaal. I was going to say, you know, Terry Venables, when he managed England, I don't know how old Terry was at the time, but he was a Frank Sinatra fan and stuff like that. He wasn't a guy that was in down with the kids, basically. He was old enough, you know, he was old enough to be people's dad or whatever. He had two coaches, if you remember that England team.
Yeah.
That's Brian Robson. Because Brian Robson walks into a dressing room and everyone's jaw drops open and they can't believe it's Brian Robson. And so he's got that guy. He's got Don Howe. And this is huge. He's got Don Howe. She thought Don was the best defensive coach in the country. And so Don would, you know, in his, you know, pork pie hat sometimes or whatever, would be taking coaching and doing all of these repetitive drills that are so important defensively. And then Terry could come out like Mr. Bojangles and go, right, now let's have a game, let's do this and almost like a little bit take the mickey out of Don, or what's he got you doing, but it was all planned. And Don didn't mind. Mm. And that's what he was there for.
And it's fascinating because you're on the mark. Terry was supposedly an incredible coach himself on the grass. So he could do it, couldn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not to. And I think if you look at Ange's career again, an incredible coach on the grass. It's just he's chosen to sort of step back. But you have. I think one of the reasons for that, and he said it in the fans forum at Spurs last week, Ange said, I'm 58 and I'm conscious that I'm ever more distant to the, in Absolutely. Age to the players. Chris is 38 and he is of the generation. He still looks like a player and there's that relatability. But they've got to have synergy. So, you know, Ange is about attacking intensity and that's exactly what Chris Davis's background is. That's what he delivered for Brendan. It's attacking. There'd be no point if he was a coach with, long ball beliefs or having one thing that's big with Ange is you can't believe in a plan B. Hmm. Plan A's just got to be better. Plan A's to go all in and
well, that's Pep as well, isn't it? He's got plan A and plan A squared, basically. That's what he's got.
And that's Chris's background too. So yeah, he said it's important not to convey to players that there's another option here.
Yeah. You describe a training session where bodies are flying into the box, all in with attacks, diving in, trying to score. Will they be doing that, Tottenham, this weekend against Liverpool? I just want to finish with looking ahead to that game because it is the big game of the weekend, 5:30 on a Saturday.
Yeah,
are you going to be there?
I'm going there. I think it'll be amazing because, yes, I think they will. I don't think they'll alter their approach one bit in any game. But we know Liverpool barely do as well. And Ange is probably a hybrid between Pep and Klopp. You know, he's got some of the Pep ideas about possession play and working out overloads. But when it comes to attacking, believes in a lot more in chaos than structure. And partly because he thinks Pep's the best in the world at that. So there's no point trying to do it. I've got to try and do something different. Mm. But yeah, I think him and Klopp is both at the top end of the pitch, very similar. And it will be a super intense game, I think.
Martin, excited about this one?
Yeah, absolutely. Very good game. It's very interesting because you've got two teams, as you say, with quite similar styles and a quite similar sense of abandon at times in the way they play. So it is going to come down to who's got the best players. And that's what makes it very interesting because Tottenham, these tests keep getting put in front of Tottenham. Oh, well, we'll see how they go against Manchester United. And they beat Manchester United. And then it was, see how they go against Arsenal. And they got a very valid point against Arsenal. If they'd have won it, it wouldn't have been a travesty of justice by any stretch of the imagination. And now it's Liverpool. And if they beat Liverpool, then you've really got to take them seriously in terms of what they can achieve this season. Not that you don't take them seriously at the moment, but there's some results that are marquee results that are, put a flag in that. And beating Liverpool. Liverpool haven't lost since April.
Something like that. It's quite a long, nearly enough
4 months they haven't lost. So that would be a very, very big result for Tottenham.
Both teams love a comeback victory as well.
They do. No one's ever out of this.
I say this before every preview of a big match, 0-0 incoming. Greg, are you at a game this weekend?
Yeah, you said that last week about Arsenal Tottenham. I was right about that, wasn't I? Two all draw and you couldn't put a sheet of paper between the two of them.
Greg, are you at a game?
I'm at one of the opening WSL fixtures, yes. Yeah. Chelsea v Spurs.
The big one. Big start to the Women's Super League season. Thanks for listening, everyone. Johnny Northcroft, Martin Samuel, Gregor Robson, thanks for joining me. Make sure you're subscribed to The Times to get Johnny's On The Whistle match report from the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium and Martin's column as well for the Sunday Times. Make sure you're tuned in on Monday. We'll be assessing all the best action from the weekend. I'm off to find myself a giant chip. We'll see you soon.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at oseamalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.